Hey everyone, welcome back.
Yeah.
Ready to dive into another fascinating topic.
Absolutely. Always excited to explore new territory.
Well, today we're strapping in for a deep dive into the world of navigation.
The art of not getting lost. Crucial skill, that.
To put it mildly, we've got a really interesting mix of sources for this one. We'll be pulling from presentation slides about different navigation techniques.
The visual aids always help.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And to add some real-world context, we've also got excerpts from an FAA handbook chapter on navigation.
The pilot's Bible for staying on course. It's got it all, real-world examples, procedures.
Oh, and it doesn't shy away from the consequences of getting it wrong.
Right out of the gate, it hits you with this case study, blind over Bakersfield.
Yeah, and that one's not just some dry aviation term. This was a real incident, a stark reminder that even with all the technology we have today,
GPS, fancy instruments.
you name it, a solid understanding of those navigation fundamentals.
It's non-negotiable.
Exactly. And our slide deck here lays out those core elements beautifully. We're talking navigation terminology, always a fun one, right?
Especially those numerous norths.
Don't get me started. We'll be tackling those. Plus, pilotage, dead reckoning, the role of GPS.
And what to do if, despite our best efforts, we find ourselves off course.
Because let's face it happens to the best of us. So think of this deep dive as your pre-flight checklist.
For navigating not just the skies, but the complexities of positional awareness itself.
Love that. Okay, let's get this show on the road, shall we? And we might as well start with those pesky norths. We've got true north, magnetic north. Is there a desert north I haven't heard about?
Maybe one we can fly to later.
Okay, jokes aside, why so many norths? Can you break it down for us?
You're right, it can seem like a compass salad. Imagine this, Earth as a giant magnet, right? But here's the catch. The magnetic North Pole isn't actually where the geographic North Pole is.
Wait, really? I always just assume.
Nope, it's hundreds of miles away over in the Arctic Ocean. And to make things even more interesting, it's constantly drifting.
Hold on, so my compass is pointing to a spot that's always on the move.
Pretty much. And that's precisely why pilots have to make those adjustments. That's where terms like true course and magnetic course come in. Let's say you're flying from, I don't know, New York to Los Angeles.
Coast to coast.
Exactly. Your true course is that straight line on the map. Shortest distance between the two, based on true north. But your compass, that's influenced by magnetic north, so it'll give you a slightly different heading.
Ah, so how do you compensate for that difference?
Variation. It's basically the angular difference between true north and magnetic north for your specific location.
So, like calibrating your compass to Earth's magnetic field at your starting point.
Exactly. And speaking of calibration, the slides also mentioned something called deviation. What did you make of that?
Yeah, another adjustment, right. But this one's not about Earth's magnetic field. It's more about,
Think magnetic interference, but coming from inside the aircraft itself.
like those electrical currents and metal components that can mess with your compass reading.
Exactly. Fine-tuning, if you will, making sure your compass isn't being swayed by the plane itself.
Which is, I imagine, pretty crucial when you're navigating hundreds or even thousands of feet in the air.
Yeah.
Speaking of finding your way, the next slide dives into pilotage.
Ah, yes, pilotage. Sounds so old school, doesn't it?
Like something out of an adventure movie. Navigating by landmarks, checkpoints. Is that still a thing, though, with GPS and all?
It's absolutely still relevant, and not just for when the GPS goes out. Think about it this way. You're flying over, say, a massive forest, and your GPS tells you to head east, but then,
What if there's a problem?
what if there's a massive thunderstorm right in your path? GPS isn't going to tell you to avoid that.
Yikes. I'd want to know how to navigate around that, GPS or no GPS.
And that's where pilotage comes in. It's about building that mental map of your surroundings, using visual cues to figure out where you are, make smart decisions about your route.
So instead of blindly following that GPS arrow,
you're using rivers, roads, railroads, even distinctive buildings, terrain features. They all become your guideposts.
connecting the dots. But instead of dots, it's rivers and mountains and such.
Exactly. And the slides made a good point about roads and railroads being especially helpful, particularly the ones that are marked on sectional charts as well-traveled,
Like highways in the sky.
guiding you towards your destination.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. But I'm curious, what about when you're flying over areas with, fewer landmarks? Like a vast desert or the open ocean. That's where dead reckoning comes in, right?
You got it. Think of it as calculated guesswork in a way.
Calculated guesswork. That sounds a bit unnerving, honestly.
Don't let that fool you. It's surprisingly accurate if you do it right. Instead of relying on what you can see, You're using math.
Math in the air. That's reassuring.
You're using things like time, your airspeed, distance, direction, and you're using those to calculate your estimated position.
So you're basically creating a trajectory.
Right.
Like if you threw a ball.
Sort of. But the tricky part is this. Your aircraft is moving within this constantly shifting air mass.
Oh, right. The wind.
And sometimes that air mass wants to take you on a little detour of its own. In fact, the handbook mentioned that in a 70-knot gale, a pilot might not even feel it if they weren't looking at the ground.
Wait, seriously? 70 knots?
That's hurricane force winds. But remember, you're moving with the air mass, like being on a giant conveyor belt. You don't feel the movement as much because you're being carried along.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
But relative to the ground, you're way off course.
Exactly. And you might not even realize it. So how do we account for this invisible force that's pushing us around up there?
Don't tell me. More math.
You know it. This is where we pull out the wind triangle.
But what now? Sounds complicated.
It's just a tool, don't worry. It helps pilots figure out how much the wind is going to affect their flight path and how to compensate. You've got to factor in the wind speed and direction along with your intended course and airspeed.
Uh-huh.
All that to get you a more accurate heading and ground speed.
Wow, so many factors. Like adjusting your sails on a sailboat.
Mm-hmm.
But instead of adjusting the sails for the wind, you're adjusting the entire plane.
That's a great analogy. It's all about working with the wind, not against it, to get where you need to go. And honestly, that's what makes navigation so fascinating. It's this constant dance between calculation, observation, adapting to the elements.
So we got pilotage for when we can actually see those landmarks, and then dead reckoning for when it's all about, you know, crunching the numbers.
Mm.
Plus, that trusty wind triangle, not as mystical as it sounds.
Oh, like pilots outsmarting the wind. But you're right. It's about having those different tools, knowing when to use each one, how they all work together to get you where you need to go.
Speaking of tools, the FAA handbook lays out this whole thing called the Pilot's Planning Sheet and Visual Flight Log. Sounds pretty official.
It's like the recipe for a successful flight, and they actually give you a sample one for a trip from Chickasha to Guthrie.
Okay, so what are the essential ingredients for this recipe? What's step one?
Always. Always start with the weather. Rule number one in aviation, always.
Checking those forecasts, making sure it's not going to be a bumpy ride.
Exactly. Any potential hazards along the route, making sure conditions are good to go.
It's like checking the traffic report before a road trip, but with a lot more turbulent.
Exactly. Then you got to dive into that airport information. Runway lengths, what services they have, radio frequencies.
Right, got to make sure you can actually land at your destination.
Exactly. You need to know what to expect on both ends of your journey. And speaking of things you need to know, fuel. Can't forget about fuel.
Right, can't exactly pull over for gas at 30,000 feet.
Exactly. Calculating that fuel consumption is crucial. You got to factor in the distance, altitude, those wind conditions we talked about, even the weight of the aircraft itself.
Oh, right, because a heavier plane uses more fuel.
You bet. And remember that 70-knot gale we were talking about earlier? That can really eat into your fuel reserves.
So it's not just filling up the tank and hoping for the best.
Not at all. You need a reserve just in case of any unexpected detours or delays. And then, after all of that is sorted out, you get to the actual charting of the course.
Okay, so plotting the route, picking out those checkpoints for pilotage if you need them.
Exactly. And this is where it gets interesting. You also have to mark any airspace restrictions or obstructions along the way.
The handbook mentions something about Class C airspace on this Chickasha to Guthrie flight. What's the deal with that?
Yeah, so Class C airspace is what you'll typically find around busier airports. More controlled traffic, so you need to be in contact with air traffic control, get clearance, follow those specific procedures. Sometimes it's just easier to navigate around it.
Like taking a scenic route to avoid highway traffic.
Exactly. And then there are those obstructions, which aren't always as obvious as you might think.
So we're talking mountains, tall buildings, that kind of thing.
Those too, but we're also talking about radio towers, antennas, even wind turbines. Those things can get surprisingly high. Your flight path needs to take all of that into account.
Got to clear those obstacles for sure. And the handbook really stressed the importance of filing a VFR flight plan.
Even if it's not legally required.
Why is that so crucial?
Think of it like leaving a note on the fridge. Hey, going here, be back then. It's that extra layer of safety so that if something happens and you don't arrive as planned, people know where to look.
Better safe than sorry, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we've talked about maps, we talked about planning, but what about those radio navigation systems? VOR, NDB, and of course, GPS.
It's like having a co-pilot in the sky. Those invisible beams, guiding you to your destination.
Okay, break it down for me. Let's start with VOR. That one sounds like it's straight out of Star Wars.
VOR stands for VHF Omnidirectional Range. It's been around for ages, and it's actually pretty cool. Imagine a network of ground stations, each one sending out radio signals, kind of like a lighthouse with its beams of light.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
Those signals, or radials, they have specific magnetic bearings that pilots can use to navigate.
So you're following a trail of radio signals, each one pointing you in a specific direction.
That's a great way to put it. VOR is known for being super accurate, but it does have one limitation: line of sight. Just like you can't see a lighthouse if there's a mountain in the way, those VOR signals can get blocked, especially at lower altitudes.
Makes sense. So what about NDB then? Another type of radio beacon, right?
Exactly. NDB stands for non-directional beacon. And unlike VOR, it doesn't use those specific radials. It just sends out a signal in every direction.
So how do you navigate with that?
You use an instrument called an ADF, or Automatic Direction Finder. It picks up that NDB signal, points you right towards the station. The cool thing about NDBs is that their signals can actually bend over the horizon, which makes them great for longer flights.
Oh, so that's really helpful for, like, overwater flights, right?
Yeah.
Where you might not have as many VOR stations.
You got it. But there's always a but, isn't there?
There's a catch, I bet.
Those NDB signals, they can be affected by all sorts of things. Atmospheric conditions, electrical interference, even mountains.
So they can be a bit unreliable.
They're not quite as precise as VOR.
Yeah.
So then we've got our trusty GPS, which has pretty much taken over the world.
Right. I feel like everyone uses GPS these days.
And for good reason. It's incredibly accurate, gives you global coverage.
Plus, no worries about mountains blocking the signal.
Exactly. But even GPS isn't perfect.
Wait, really? What could possibly go wrong with GPS?
Well, it relies on those satellites, right? Sometimes you lose signal or the signal's all degraded, especially in certain atmospheric conditions, or if you're flying near tall structures that interfere. And like any electronic system, GPS units themselves can just malfunction.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. So even in the age of GPS, it's good to have a backup plan.
Always. You can never have too many navigation skills up your sleeve.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings us to a topic I'm sure every pilot dreads. Lost procedures.
Okay, now we're getting serious. What exactly are lost procedures? Is that like the pilot's version of hitting the panic button?
Not quite. Think of it as a mental checklist for that moment when you realize, wait a minute, where am I?
I'm already feeling anxious just thinking about it.
Understandable. But the key here is to stay calm. Don't panic. And luckily, that FAA handbook has got your bag. It's got this whole step-by-step guide for exactly this situation.
Okay, that's somewhat reassuring. So what's the first thing you actually do when you realize you're lost? Do you just start flying in circles hoping you'll spot something familiar?
Definitely not. One of the first things you do, if conditions allow, of course, is try to climb to a higher altitude.
Why is that? To get a better view?
That's part of it. But it's also about improving your radio reception. You're more likely to reach air traffic control or a flight service station at a higher altitude so you can call for some help.
So it's about getting help, but also giving yourself a wider perspective, literally. Okay, what happens once you're at a higher altitude? What's next?
Well, if you have radio navigation equipment like VOR, ADF, or even GPS, you can try to figure out where you are by plotting bearings from different stations.
Ah, so it's like triangulation, using those signals to pinpoint your location.
Exactly. And if you can get in touch with a ground station, even better. They might have radar. They can give you vectors, basically directions to guide you back on course.
Okay, that is reassuring. Knowing there's someone on the ground who can help you out.
They're like your navigation guardian angels. And in a real pinch, you can always transmit a distress call in the emergency frequency. Set your transponder to 7700. That lets everyone nearby know that you need help.
It's good to know there's a plan, even when you're lost.
Exactly. You're not just blindly hoping for the best. You've got procedures. You've got the knowledge to handle those uh-oh moments. Because at the end of the day, that's what makes a good pilot, not just knowing how to fly, but knowing how to handle the unexpected.
So it's like that saying, right? It's not about avoiding the storm. It's about learning to sail the ship.
Huh.
Except in this case, the ship is a plane. And the storm could be anything from, you know, a flock of geese to a failed instrument.
That's a great way to put it. Navigation is all about being prepared for anything, having the skills to adapt.
And speaking of adaptation, let's talk about flying at night. I imagine that throws a whole other wrench in the works, navigationally speaking.
It does. When you lose those visual cues you rely on during the day, well, your other senses and those instruments, they become even more crucial.
It's like having to navigate by braille instead of sight.
That's a great analogy. And you're right, it requires a completely different approach to pilotage.
So instead of rivers and roads, you're looking for what?
You're looking for things that stand out in the dark. Cities, towns. Those show up as those clusters of light on your chart, so they're great checkpoints. Airports, obviously, with their beacons and runway lights, those become even more important. And sometimes it's about looking for the absence of light.
What do you mean?
Like that dark silhouette of a mountain range against the horizon, that can tell you a lot about where you are.
So you're learning to read a whole new set of visual cues.
Exactly. And your instruments, those radio navigation systems we were talking about earlier, they become even more important. You're relying on those to maintain your course, your altitude, to give you a sense of position when your eyes can't always be trusted.
Because I imagine it's got to be tough to judge things like altitude, distance, when you don't have those visual references.
It takes practice, for sure. A good instrument scan. But we could spend a whole other deep dive on night flying techniques.
Maybe we will. Okay, so we've talked about navigating over flat terrain. We've talked about overwater flying. But what about when those landmarks turn into, well, mountains?
Ah, mountain flying. That's a whole other ballgame. It's the ultimate test for a pilot, I'd say. Not only are you dealing with all the usual challenges of weather, but you've also got these unpredictable updrafts, downslopes.
And don't forget about those peaks.
Exactly. You're navigating through this maze of peaks and valleys. It's like a whole different world up there.
The views must be incredible, though.
Oh, breathtaking. But you can't get too distracted by the scenery because mountain flying demands your full attention.
So how do you even begin to navigate in those conditions?
Pilotage is still key. But you've got to be really careful about those checkpoints you choose. Those peaks that look super distinctive from one angle might blend in with all the others when you're looking at them from a different direction.
Oh, right. It's like those optical illusions where the image changes depending on how you look at it.
Exactly. You have to constantly be aware of where you are in relation to the terrain. Always be thinking a few steps ahead.
And I bet the wind is a huge factor in those situations.
Absolutely. Mountains create their own weather systems with updrafts, downdrafts, and something called mountain wave turbulence.
That doesn't sound good.
It's not. It can be really dangerous, actually.
Making me a bit queasy just thinking about it.
It's not for the faint of heart, that's for sure. But if you talk to any pilot who's flown in the mountains, they'll tell you it's the most exhilarating type of flying there is.
I can believe it. It's like the ultimate dance between human skill and Mother Nature.
Perfectly said. And speaking of challenging environments, we can't forget about overwater flying. Now, that is a true test of your navigation skills.
Because out there, It's just you, the plane, and a whole lot of blue.
Right. You're navigating this vast, featureless expanse.
So no relying on your trusty paper map.
Not a good idea. Overwater flying takes really meticulous planning, reliable equipment, and a deep understanding of dead reckoning.
Because if you're off course by even a little bit, those miles can add up quickly.
Exactly. And it's not just about finding your way. It's about what happens if you have to make an emergency landing. You need to have the right survival gear. You need to know how to use your radio. And you need to be mentally prepared for what to do if you're stranded out there.
It makes you appreciate those tiny islands, that's for sure.
It really does. And it highlights something else that's so crucial for navigation, something we haven't even talked about yet. Mental navigation.
Mental navigation. Is that like using the force to find your way?
Not quite, but it's definitely a skill that comes with practice, with really understanding how to read the environment. It's about being able to visualize your flight path, anticipate any changes, and make decisions based on what you know about the weather, the terrain, how your aircraft handles.
So it's like having this internal compass guiding you even when your instruments might be telling you something different.
Exactly. It's about trusting your gut, but also knowing when to double check those instincts against your instruments.
Sounds like mental navigation is something that develops over time with experience and a lot of careful observation.
It really does. It's about developing this connection with your aircraft, the environment, the whole art of flying.
Wow. We have covered a lot of ground today, from the basics like pilotage and dead reckoning to these more, I don't know, advanced forms of navigation, night flying, mountain flying, even mental navigation. It's pretty amazing when you think about everything that goes into getting from point A to point B safely.
It is, and I think the biggest takeaway here is that navigation is a journey. It's this ongoing process of learning, challenging yourself, and never stopping exploring.
And that applies whether you're a seasoned pilot or, you know, just starting out.
Absolutely. Having those solid navigation skills, it just opens up a world of possibilities.
It lets you see the world from a different perspective, push those boundaries. It's incredible.
Yeah. Couldn't have said it better myself.
Well, on that note, it looks like we've reached our final destination for today's deep dive.
It's been a pleasure sharing the journey with you, as always.
And to our listeners, thank you for joining us on this incredible exploration of navigation. Until next time, keep exploring, keep learning, and most importantly, keep navigating your own path.